If there's one thing I can't stand, it's a smart aleck kid.
All right. Hello, everybody. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, and welcome to our show. I am live this weekend and lively, ready to talk with you about anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. 1-800-227-5278 is my number if you're in the 714 area code local here to our studios, KBRT in Costa Mesa. You can dial up 754-4150. That would be the 714 area code. So we have abbreviated show today because we're in the, at least for the Southern California market, so I want to get right onto things. That's because, you know, we go off the air about 20 minutes here in Southern California before the end of our 5 o'clock hour because the sun's going down earlier with daylight savings time. So let me move quickly into some thoughts that I have. And then, of course, lines are open and you're willing to – or you're free if you're willing to get in the queue, talk to the enforcer, and then you can talk to me here. But I what I want to talk with you about today is based on a convergence of a couple of things – that have happened in the last couple of weeks, or that have happened to me in the last couple of weeks. I have been on the road a tremendous amount, and to be honest with you, it's hard to recall where I was when, but I think I was here last week, and the week before that I was not. But in the meantime, between those just before and just after, I've been to Washington, D.C., spoke on Capitol Hill there to a group of what are called Hill Rats. These are actually, that's an insider's term I read on a book title somewhere. These are the people who really run Washington. These are the ones who basically help all the senators and congressmen do their jobs, and they do the heavy lifting while the elected officials get all the FaceTime on TV. In any event, I was there, and then I was in Boston last week, and now I'm back for a while, at least on the West Coast, and I'm glad for that. But some of you might have caught a radio show that I was on, because it was a national broadcast about 3 weeks ago, maybe 2 weeks ago. And Stu Epperson Jr. was the radio talk show host, and I was his guest, though I was a talk show host, and he had another talk show host as another guest. So two guests are talk jocks, and he's the talk jock, and so you got a lot of talking going on one radio show. The other guest was Bob Inyart from Denver area, and he and I were talking about the issue of how do you vote? What are the right guidelines for voting, not who does one vote for? I can't engage in that kind of conversation because we're 501c3. But how does one vote, given the pro-life issue and the candidates at hand, and what's the best way to use one's vote? And we got into quite a tussle at that time. I want to speak to that issue, not because I care about reliving that fight on the air, as it were, but I want to talk about the issue that goes to the bottom of this. We were talking about, is it ever right to vote for a pro-choice candidate? And my answer, of course, is yes, because my obligation as a Christian or as a morally thinking person, even, let's cast the net a bit broader there, is to cast my vote in a way that does the greatest good possible given the set of circumstances I'm facing in the moment. And so the hypothetical was, if we have a Giuliani candidacy on the Republican side and a Clinton candidacy on the Democratic side, then what is my obligation, in my view, as a pro-life voter? And some have said, I will never vote for a pro-life candidate. I'm sorry, I will never vote for a pro-choice candidate, some have said. Notably, Jim Dobson, and Bob Inyart was on his side in this regard, because to them it's all or nothing. I either vote for a pro-life candidate, or I don't vote. I either vote to end all abortions, or I don't vote to end any. Bob Inyart holds that view. Dobson doesn't. But his view was, if you vote just to end partial birth abortion, this is implicitly a vote in favor of the abortions that are not proscribed by that legislation. Now, I think that's crazy. And I think most of you do, too. But again, I'm not going to fight that fight. I want to direct my attention to another problem that came up during that show that is a problem and a mistake that is made so frequently that it requires some clear statements about it so you're not confused on this issue. And it has to do with the issue of relativism. And I have been fond of quoting a statement out of Barna that says that most two-thirds of all born-again Christian adults are relativists, and 91.5% of all born-again Christian teenagers are also moral relativists. It's based on something that Barna has said, and I think this is a reliable statistic, although when I look at the question that was asked from which Barna gets this information, I was troubled by the question. Because the question was this, and all of this relates back to this debate about the pro-life question and how we should vote and what relativism is or is not. The question was, do you think that morals depend upon the circumstance? Morals are absolute or they depend upon the circumstances? I think that's the way the question was put by Barna. Now, that kind of question troubles me. I have another poll here by Barna about youths that are increasingly shunning Christianity. And I'm troubled by this poll, too, not the results, but the way the poll was done. Because if I were having if I were the subject of this particular poll that was taken that let us know how many people in the church are relativists, if I were the one being asked the question and they asked the question to me that way, are morals dependent upon circumstances, my answer would have been yes, but I'm not a relativist. Now, that's partly because of what I know about nuances of the definitions of the terms, etc., which I'll share with you in just a moment. And I don't think most of the people polled understood that. I think they just understood that question to be a simple objectivist, relativist kind of question. Do you believe in objective truth, or do you believe that moral truth depends on the circumstances, and they would read that as relativism, and therefore they would then respond in light of that perceived or presumed meaning and give their information then. And that's why I quote the statistic, because I do think, by and large, those who answered that question answered that they think morals are relative. But the question itself doesn't actually tell you that, because apparently even George Barna is confused about what a relativist is. Now, this came home to me in spades during this interview a couple of weeks ago with Stu Epperson Jr. and Bob Inyart, in which I was arguing that given the fact or the eventuality, and I don't even know that it's eventuality, but if it took place that we had a pro-choice Republican candidate and a pro-choice Democratic candidate, then I am morally obliged to vote for the pro-choice Republican candidate. Because better is, as one person put it, a second-class fireman than a first-class arsonist. The Democrat, for my money, will do a lot more damage than the Republican will do. There's some restraints on the Republican side on the pro-choice issue. When it comes to another Clinton presidency, no such restraints exist. And so I think greater harm will come to the country with pro-choicer Senator Clinton than pro-choicer Rudy Giuliani. Now, of course, in order to make such a statement, I am suggesting that the circumstances are relevant in making my moral choice, where Bob Inyart was saying, look, I'm pro-life, that means I vote pro-life, and I don't care what the circumstances are, I don't care what the candidates are or who they are, it is my job to vote pro-life. That's my absolute principle. And Mr. Kochel, since you are now bending to the circumstances, you are making your decision based on the nature of the situation instead of letting your decision be driven by this absolute truth that requires you to vote pro-life, then you are guilty of situational ethics and you're a relativist. Now, this was the charge that was leveled to me. Yours truly, Mr. Kochel, author of Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair, by Bob Inyart on this program a couple of weeks ago. I was the relativist. Now, I explained to him that he is not understanding the terms correctly, that situational ethics is not a term that describes somebody who makes their ethical decisions simply based on the situation. Situational ethics is capital S, capital E. These aren't descriptive terms. These are proper nouns that describe a specific ethical system that was advanced by Joseph Fletcher, which system, by the way, ironically, is not a relativistic system, but an absolutist system. It is the same kind of system that Bob Inyart was advancing on his during that interview and apparently on his own radio show. People make this mistake all the time. They think that if you take the situation into consideration when you're making a moral decision, that makes you a relativist because it's situational ethics. It's not situational ethics. I know what situational ethics is. It is not that. The fact is that every single moral decision that you make, in order to be sound, must of necessity take into consideration the nature of the circumstances you're facing. And this could be demonstrated very, very simply. Is it wrong to push an old lady? And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, that depends. Precisely. If my intent is to push her, and my motive is because I'm angry at her because she left me out of her will, then the action is bad. If my intent is to push her and my motive is to get her out of the way of a speeding vehicle, then the action is good. Notice that the action is the same in both cases, pushing grandma. But what's different is the nature of the circumstances and my motive given the nature of the circumstances. Is it wrong to kill? Depends, doesn't it? If you're killing as a result of capital punishment, then arguably at least that's legitimate. If you're killing in cold blood with no good reason, then it's not. If it's an act of vengeance for some slight or wrong done to you, then this is homicide. And those two illustrations ought to make it very, very clear that the circumstances themselves are relevant questions in whether or not an act is moral. And indeed, if you're trying to do the moral thing, that is, if you have moral convictions about the pro-life issue, you have to have some standards by which you're going to judge. The problem with saying, here's my standard, it's an absolute from which I will never vary. I will never vote for a pro-choice candidate. It may turn out that you are in a set of circumstances in which not voting for a pro-choice candidate will allow you to keep your word and will actually cause more deaths. Now, I can't go into a lot of detail right now about how that might take place. We've talked about some of that in the past, but the point I'm making is if I'm pro-life, my obligation is to save as many lives as I can, given the circumstances I'm facing, not just to make a pietistic pledge to never vote for a pro-choice candidate, and then follow that rule regardless of what bad becomes of my actions. And so I've always campaigned for making a strategic vote here. Now, I have been a little bit surprised, actually a little bit is an understatement, when Pat Robertson came out in favor of Rudy Giuliani just the last couple of days. I'm thinking, what is he thinking? Has he lost his mind? Because I can't imagine what Rudy Giuliani stands for that Pat Robertson could stand behind as a values voter, a Christian, except for war on terror. Because in the gun control, homosexuality, same-sex marriage, abortion issues, he comes up on the wrong side, at least from what I think Pat Robertson's sentiments are. Now, we could speculate as to what's going on in Robertson's mind. I don't know. I have contended a while back that it's time for him to hang up his cleats. And maybe this is an example to the rest of the world that it's time for him to hang up his cleats or we shouldn't take him seriously. Because from a value side, there are a lot of other candidates that are better off. Now, he might think that this is the only candidate that can beat Hillary Clinton. Fine, wait until the general, when the two are head-to-head and then vote for your man. Throw your lot in with your man, Giuliani. In the meantime, there are some better choices, it seems to me, for values voters. And when I say values voters, I mean those voters who seem to share those values that people like Pat Robertson have, Christian values. And so that's why in my conversations then and now, I'm not endorsing any particular candidate. I'm not telling you who to vote for. I'm telling you the kinds of things that ought to inform your vote. And circumstances always are factors in the discussion which vote is morally required. And here's where I need to make a clarification that I think Barna gets it wrong, Bob Inyart gets it wrong, and a whole bunch of other people get it wrong. They are confused about moral relativism. You've got to know that I was a bit stunned when I was called a relativist on the show, not once, but a dozen times. And at first I thought, well, this gentleman doesn't understand what he's talking about. He doesn't have his definitions right. I explained that I wasn't a situational ethics guy. I know what that is. Joseph Fletcher, I know the details. I know how it works. I'm not that guy. And I explained I'm not a relativist. I know what relativism is. I reminded Mr. Inyart that I wrote the book on relativism. Now, it doesn't mean I can't make a mistake. But doesn't it strike you as a little bit unlikely that a person who writes a book on relativism would not know what relativism is, and the person who doesn't write the book would? At least the benefit of the doubt should go to me. But I'm going to explain to you in very, very crisp, clear philosophical terms the difference between a moral relativist and a moral objectivist. Because those are the two terms. Those are the two choices. And when I say moral objectivist, I mean the same as in principle what most people mean by absolutes. Although I don't like the term, I think it's confusing. A moral relativist, or let me put it this way, moral relativism is when the truth of any moral statement depends entirely on the belief of the person saying it. Or to put it a little differently, when the truth of any moral statement depends entirely on the subject, that is, the person or the individual who believes it. This is why moral relativism is also called moral subjectivism. So, moral relativism, moral subjectivism, moral non-realism, all are the same thing. And what makes it relative is, and this is why, you know, the word relativism is an unfortunate word, because it doesn't tell you what things are relative to what in the concept of the kind of relativism that you ought to be concerned about. It's when the truth of a moral statement is relative to the subject or the individual, not relative to the circumstances. Moral relativism is when the truth of a moral statement depends entirely on the belief of the subject. So if you believe it's wrong, then it's wrong for you, and that's as far as it goes. If I believe it's right, then it's right for me, as far as it goes. And it's right and wrong at the same time, with no conflict, because they're held by two different subjects, two different people. That's moral relativism. Moral objectivism, by contrast, is when the truth of any moral statement is based on the details of the objective situation. Now, this would include not just the act itself, but also the motive and the intent of the act. So the situation could be exactly the same, but the motive and intent, that is the physical circumstances or the action, could be the same, but the motive and intent could be different, and therefore the moral quality of that act could be different too, just like killing. In some cases, it's right. In some cases, it's wrong. It depends on the situations. That is not situational ethics. That is not relativism. That is objectivism. All truth claims depend on the circumstance, ladies and gentlemen. That's called the correspondence view of truth. My statement is true if it corresponds to the set of circumstances that statement is about. That's true whether I'm talking about this pencil is on the desk or whether I'm talking about it's wrong to do that act at this time under those circumstances. Whether or not it's right or wrong depends entirely on the circumstances. If the circumstances change, then quite possibly the moral quality of the action changes as well. So it is good moral thinking when your decisions are dependent on the circumstances, not bad moral thinking. It is quite the opposite of what some people think. Moral choices always depend on the circumstances. It cannot be any other way. That is not relativism. That is objectivism. Relativism is when the moral answers depend not on the circumstances, but just on the individual person, whatever he thinks at that time, his whims, his beliefs, whatever. That's enough to make it true, if he thinks so. That's the relativism. That's the problem. All right, you'll probably want to ask some questions about that, and I'd be glad to answer them if you like. I have to go to break here, but then I'll be taking your calls. 1-800-227-5278 in the 714 area code 754-4150. I'm Greg Kokel.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
The dictionary defines the word expand this way: a verb, to open up, to unfold, to increase the extent, number, volume, or scope of. Stand to Reason's focus in 2007 is expanding horizons, a goal born out of our desire to increase your understanding of what it means to be Christ's ambassador and to open up the riches of truth in new ways and explore new ways to be more effective as an ambassador for Christ. No conference is better at doing that than our annual Master Series in Christian Thought. This year's lineup of speakers will challenge you to expand your horizons as you face the pressures of being a Christian in today's world. These extraordinary minds will broaden and deepen your understanding of truth amidst an antagonistic and divisive culture. Never has the need been greater for Christians who confidently and competently defend what they believe. You can order the lectures individually, or even better, you can benefit from the entire series. Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. James Emery White, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, and our own Greg Kokel and Alan Schliemann. Visit str.org or call 800-2-REASON to order this series that will expand your horizons.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog.
Greg Kokel back with you here at Stand to Reason, giving you a piece of my mind today. And I'll be getting your calls in just a second. By the way, my congratulations to Aaron Snell at Porterville, California. He's we're sending you a free copy of Relativism, and you are our Frapper winner for this week. And Frapper, of course, is the map where you can kind of post your location on our website. If you go there and go to the iPod section, there's a map there. You can post that you listen. And if you post your location, kind of pin the flag on the map kind of thing, and let us know you're part of our listening community, we'll put your name in a grab bag, and we choose from that list every single week, and we send out a gift. So, Aaron Snell in Porterville, you are the fortunate recipient, and we'll be sending that book. I just signed it today, so it's on the way. the enforcer came in and just mentioned something she had heard recently about waterboarding and torture, and a blogger who mentioned, well, the ends never justify the means. Now, if you're fond of saying this sentence, the ends never justify the means, I encourage you to drop it forever from your vocabulary. And the reason is, let me ask you this. Is it right to vote for a pro-life candidate with the intention of trying to end abortion? If you say yes, then I say, well, then the means do justify the ends, don't they? I got it around backwards. Therefore, the ends do justify the means. The end being stopping abortion, the means mean casting your vote. So if you say the ends never justify the means, then you mean that no end is justified by any mean, and this is stupid. What you may mean is that in this circumstance, the particular ends in question are not justified by the means you have in mind. If that's what you mean, say that and don't say this other thing that's silly. The ends never justify the means. Nonsense. There is always a relationship between means and ends, and this is the nature of moral decision making. We always have to look at what is the end in view, what is the means to accomplish that end, and is this means a morally acceptable means to accomplish that particular end? That's the way you make moral decisions. In fact, I'm not telling you anything new. This is what you already do. And so to try to gainsay or contradict or deny somebody's point of view with a statement, well, the ends never justify the means, is not going to work because you've just said something nutty. Incoherent, really. I mean, silly. You may be meaning something else, then you should break it down a little bit more and say these ends are not justified by these means, and here's the reasons why. But don't throw that out like it's somehow it's a magic wand and it's going to get you to win your argument just because you say it. There's always a relationship between means and ends. Okay, let's go to the phones, and let's go to Alden in Paradise, California. And Alden, Jesus said to the thief, tonight you will be with me in paradise. You're already there, aren't you?
I already am. Thank you, Dr. Koch, for taking my call.
You're welcome, but I'm not a doctor. I'm just a double master.
I just assumed with all that talking, you probably had a couple degrees.
But yeah, I do have a couple degrees, but not that particular one.
Okay.
I actually have 3 degrees.
Okay, well.
I'm dying by degrees.
I've enjoyed your show over the past couple months. I've actually just been listening to it for a month, but in that time I've gone through and started downloading all the old shows and
kind
of stuff, so really enjoying that.
Super. Glad to hear it, Alden. Thanks.
Two questions today. The enforcer said I got to ask two of them, so I'm excited about that.
All right.
We'll see if we get to both. If you run out of time.
You got on board before everybody else was in the queue. That's why she gave that, but we'll honor her word there.
Sounds good. My first question is, you've talked a couple times about, there's been two examples. You've used the example of the man who has no personal sin in his life and therefore has no need of Christ. He'll be able to enter heaven by his own merits.
Right.
As well as talking about the child before they reach an age of accountability, therefore they have no personal sin in their life, therefore they will enter the kingdom.
Yeah, that isn't quite precisely the way I put it in both cases, but I'll be glad to clarify.
Okay. I guess I'm just curious. I've been going to a Catholic school. I just graduated from there for the last 4 years. And learned a lot about the concept of original sin.
Mm-hmm.
How does original sin work with that view?
Okay, I was making it. Let's start with forget the baby for a minute. Let's just start with the other person.
Mm-hmm.
I made a statement which may have sounded like to some people a little extreme, but I was trying to make a particular point. And I think the context in which the statement about the person who has no personal sin has no sin against his account.
Mm-hmm.
I think I made that in the context of a conversation about who needs Jesus and who doesn't.
Yeah.
And my point was, if one is not a sinner, then he doesn't need to be saved because he's not lost.
Mm-hmm.
So people say, what about the good Buddhist or the good Muslim or, you know, who never hears about Jesus?
Mm-hmm.
And I say, well, the good, fill in the blank, goes directly to heaven because if he's good, then he's not lost and therefore he doesn't need to be saved.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus didn't need to be saved. He was good and he went directly to heaven, okay?
That's an interesting case just because Jesus was, we know, the one man who was without original sin.
Right.
That's kind of a...
Exactly. Well, this is kind of my point. My point is that when people ask the question, what about the good person who dies? What happens to him? Does he need Jesus? I am taking their statement kind of at face value. I'm saying no, good people don't need him. It's only people who have sin on their account, who have sinned or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it turns out everybody's in that second category,
okay.
None in the first. And I say it that way because I want to make the point that the point of Jesus is to punish, is to rescue sinners from their just punishment, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It isn't like there's a little detail that God threw in here about believing in his son just to make things difficult when a whole bunch of people would normally go to heaven, but now he's thrown in this little requirement about believing in his son and they never heard of his son, so now they're going to get tricked into going to hell. That misses the point. The good person goes to heaven, the bad person goes to hell. Then I ask, where's the good person? He doesn't exist. Not good in terms of what God requires. There is good between you and I. We can compare ourselves to each other and say, well, I'm better than him. Or maybe I'm a lot better than him. But as I pointed out to others, you may not, and I don't mean you personally, Alden, but one may not be a Hitler, but you're not a Jesus Christ either. And most of us are more like Hitler than like Jesus.
Yeah.
And Jesus is a standard. So I'm not denying that people have sins in their lives or are influenced or infected, if you will, by original sin. I hold to both. This is a rhetorical device to help people see that good people who are really good don't need a savior, but the fact is nobody is like that. All of us are criminals before God one way or another, and therefore we're all under condemnation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then the next question comes up, well, wait a minute. So you say we have our personal sins and you have original sin. Gee, what happens to the baby, for example, who dies, who has, as you put it, original sin and therefore is guilty,
mm-hmm.
but has not, you know, he's never had a chance to receive Jesus. He goes to hell without ever even received the chance. And then what I've done is constructed an answer that I think is pretty similar to Ron Nash's answer in his book, When a Baby Dies. And it's nuanced and it's speculative because I don't know the answer to this. The scripture doesn't speak directly.
Mm-hmm.
The things that I know for sure are all human beings, in virtue of being conceived human by other human parents, are participants in the sin of Adam,
mm-hmm.
classically called original sin, and in virtue of that are born under God's judgment. And this is classic Christian theology, Roman Catholic, Protestant, right down the line.
Yeah, yeah.
The alternative is called Pelagianism, which is a heresy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I also know that in Revelations 20, we see the great white throne judgment and the criterion upon which God judges are the books which have in them the deeds of people that show them to be guilty. And if every person who is judged by his deeds, which is every person, is found guilty and thrown into the lake of fire, except those whose names are written in the book of life. Now, those in the book of life, of course, are equally guilty. It's just that they have been covered by the sacrifice of the Savior, and they've been rescued from this plight. So my conclusion then about the baby is, well, the babies do have sin, for sure, original sin, but they have never committed any actual sin in their lives because they didn't live that long.
Yeah.
And so there's nothing in terms of their chosen sin that is on the certificate of debt. And so I am concluding then, and this is, I could be mistaken about this, that children who die before the age of accountability are sovereignly covered by the grace of God in their original sin because they haven't been found wanting in the other way that we see in Revelations chapter 20.
Okay, so... And that I guess kind of links with some of your other discussions with inclusivists, where you mention I guess the requirements for what it takes to be covered by the blood of Christ, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so you think that the blood of Christ can cover without a conscious act. It can cover original sin, but there has to be a conscious acceptance of it for it to cover personal sin?
Yes. I am certain about the second and not certain about the first.
Okay.
I'm speculating about the first. Now, I know that the point in inclusivism, for those who are not familiar with the term, is the idea that Jesus' blood is necessary for salvation, as in the salvation of the child or the infant,
mm-hmm.
But one does not have to exercise faith in Jesus for that blood to be applied. Now, that is the Roman Catholic view, not just with regards to infants, but with regards to people in other religions.
Mm-hmm.
So the good Buddhist or good Hindu, etc., could be, or the sincere Buddhist or Hindu. It's nuanced. I'm just giving it a kind of summary here. They can be saved by the blood of Christ, even though they don't believe in Jesus. I actually think the New Testament absolutely disqualifies that option. In the New Testament times, you can look at Old Testament examples. But whatever is happening in the Old Testament, it doesn't apply to the New Testament times because the New Testament commands and directives and examples are entirely different. And that's why I was quick to qualify. I am biblically certain about the second, that the inclusivism isn't true with regards to people who can make conscious choices and who have actual sins to their own accounts, in a sense, who've done bad things. But even though I think God is capable of doing that, we know he doesn't do that because people above the age of accountability because we see these clear statements. Yet with people under the age of accountability, there is no statement one way or another. And so I am offering a speculation that he does apply it in those cases.
Okay.
So
kind of almost like a neo-inclusivism, sort of.
Well, neonatal inclusivism might be better.
Sounds good.
That kind of does that make sense there?
That makes sense to
okay.
me. And that's a tie-in with my second question. Just to avoid getting accused of sandbagging here, I do have inclusivist tendencies. I
that's right.
grew up with Lewis a lot and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I had never really had that challenge much before.
Yeah. But Lewis, as far as I know, doesn't develop his inclusivism. He just presumes it in one of his novels.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I had just sort of taken that. So I guess I heard one of your talks about inclusivism. I don't know when the podcast was. I've been downloading so many of them.
Okay.
It was one of the ones, and you brought up the example of God essentially commanding Peter to go to Cornelius. And
Acts chapter 10.
With him.
Right.
Yeah, Acts chapter 10.
Right.
And I think, at least from the inclusivism that I would consider myself a part of, that's a bit of a straw man, because at least I think a biblically based inclusivism would still say it's good to preach to the unchristians, because as a Christian we have the surety of heaven, and as not as a Christian, there's simply the possibility of heaven. And so I think that...
Well, I don't understand. If the Christian fulfills the requirement for salvation, mm-hmm. then we have the surety of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
But if in the inclusive sense, the non-Christian fulfills the whatever requirements they are for them being saved in the inclusivist sense, they have the same assurance. They just may not know it, but they don't need to know it, because they're putting their confidence in a totally different religious system anyway, and are fully emotionally satisfied in that other system. So I don't see the advantage to that.
Okay, well,
does that make sense?
Maybe then that's what I don't know inclusivism that well, just from what you've mentioned. So maybe I guess a nuance to that view that I would hold would say that they might be saved outside of a specific conscious I follow Christ sinner's prayer, whatever you want to call it. They might be saved, we don't know.
Okay,
that's
let's just
be the view I hold. And does the Peter and Cornelius deal with that at all, or is that a different point?
Okay, first with regards to your statement, even if I granted that, and I could, I probably, I'm not perfect, maybe I'm mistaken here, they might be. What if I were to say that?
Mm-hmm.
What possibly could be the advantage of us holding such a thing, teaching such a thing, reflecting on such a thing, advancing such a thing? I don't see any benefit to that. It's like best case scenario, more people are in heaven, on my side, more people in heaven than I anticipated. Okay.
Yeah.
Best case scenario in your side is like, I mean, worst case scenario, there's no downside from my view.
Mm-hmm.
Best case scenario in your side, there's no upside, it seems. The downside is a whole bunch of people have been kind of given confidence that they're okay, when in fact they're not. They're
in
peril.
And I agree. It's a very dangerous doctrine.
Okay.
Hence, I'm not going to go around sharing that with people. That's not going to be one of the points I'm going to be evangelizing.
Okay.
I bring it up on this radio show because we are dealing with
Christians. Of course. No. So let me offer one other thought. So I think there's kind of a Pascal's wager thing that's important in the balance here. But secondly, and I actually have been – I've had Roman Catholic priests shake their finger at me basically in interfaith conversations on the air, for mm-hmm. example, for trying to proselytize others. In fact, it happened to me just – 2 weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago, with a priest on the air on NPR in San Francisco. So the same kind of thing, you know, this is an intolerant approach, you know. So, I mean, this kind of thing happens a lot coming from Rome, at least American Roman Catholics. But the other thing that is completely a textual issue, what justification do we have anywhere in the New Testament to suspect that people could be, and I'm focusing on the New Testament because we're in a New Testament era now.
Yeah.
Maybe there might have been exceptions in the past. All right, whatever. But now, when we've been given the Great Commission, when we are sent out to all the nations to do this, what justification do we have at all to expect that inclusivism is true, that people can be saved through other religions, when virtually all these other religions are examples of egregious violations of the First Commandment, which violation God exiled Israel for breaking? And so, anyway, so why would we want to advance that idea? Where would we get the impression? I use Acts chapter 10 because here is the best the Gentiles could offer back then, a God-fearer who the text says, Cornelius, who the text says that prayed to God and gave alms, and that God heard his prayers.
Yeah.
So it seems to me this is best case scenario. If anybody on the inclusivistic doctrine would be kind of in and covered, and we don't have to worry about him, Cornelius was. But Peter had to go speak to Cornelius. He's commanded to give him this information because Cornelius would have been lost without it. That would be my conclusion from the text. So I have no good reason theologically to believe in inclusivism, and I have many reasons theologically, textually, to believe in exclusivism. I see no advantages to believing inclusivism. In inclusivism, I see many grave dangers to promoting it. So,
and I agree with the point about the dangers and the benefits to inclusivism versus not. I agree it's a very dangerous doctrine, and
mm-hmm.
we do see a lot of abuses of it today that really undermine Christianity. But we both know, I mean, you can't judge an academic thought by the abuses of it. So,
well, no, but I actually think inclusivism itself is the abuse.
Granted.
That's my problem. It's not just that this is a good idea that people take to the wrong extremes. It's a bad idea, and I can't see in any way that this is being taught that would be useful.
But you can't use the fact that it's at least the view I hold that some do. You can't say that because that gets abused by some people to bad means that we both agree are bad. You can't use that as a thing against
no,
my doctrine.
I,
you just
I,
say it's an abuse is possible, but and that's sad. But
well,
that's
no, I think you missed my point, and that was I think that the doctrine of inclusivism is per se abusive,
mm-hmm.
not some uses that people put the doctrine to.
Okay.
I think the doctrine itself is a danger, and this is why I stand so aggressively against it.
Okay,
and
would that be against inclusivism that they may go to heaven, which is kind of the view that I'm holding, and I don't know if that's inclusivism proper, or they will go to heaven, which would seem to be a different...
No, to say that they may go to heaven is just simply being, acknowledging one's own limitations in a sense, or that you could be mistaken, or being an agnostic about it.
Okay.
But inclusivism is not the view that one may go to heaven through the merits of Christ, even if you don't believe in him. Inclusivism is the view that you can.
Okay.
It's part of the system.
Okay, so I can hold that you may go to heaven. I don't know how God applies that to people. I know for me it's good to be a Christian because I have the assurance of God's promise, and I know that his blood will be applied to my sins.
Yeah, I don't think your statement there is completely justified. I think it's fair for you to say it may be the case,
mm-hmm.
but to say we don't know that it's not the case I think is unjustified because knowledge is justified true belief. If we have good reasons to believe in a particular view, I think it's fair to say we know it. There is not a shred of evidence in the New Testament for inclusivism. And in fact, it seems to me that inclusivism is so dangerous when it's taught that its authorship isn't God but the devil. It's part of the darkness of it. Now, could I be mistaken about that? Yeah. Could God sovereignly select someone and save him who has never heard of Jesus? Yeah, so I could say that, but I have no good reason to say it's not. It is the case that he does that,
mm-hmm.
and in the New Testament era, and so therefore I am going to stand on exclusivism as the teaching of the New Testament, and I think this can be defended. Does that clarification help?
Yeah, and the verses, the principal things defending it, you believe would be. I remember you referenced a verse one time, but I couldn't find that podcast again today. What was the verse again that basically says you have to have an open acknowledgement of Christ for there?
Well, I could just rattle off dozens of them.
Okay.
To them who received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, even to those who believed in his name. John chapter 1, verse 14.
Okay.
And if you believe in your heart, God, if you confess with your mouth Jesus as Lord, and you believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, then you will be saved. Romans chapter 10.
But those verses, I mean, those are saying a way to have his blood covering you is this. Those verses don't say the only way to have his blood cover your sins is to do that.
Yes, I don't think that's a legitimate distinction. I know the words don't say it as precisely as you described, but I think we'll just skip the break. Yeah, okay. Those words don't, because this is important. Thank you. They just gave up on, they had the break sign up for 5 minutes, and they said, all right, we're going to miss this one.
Sorry.
No, that's right. This is important, and I appreciate talking about this with you. I think the implicit, I mean, virtually explicit in those statements is the requirement for belief. It isn't just simply saying, well, you know, if you happen to confess with your mouth, then you are saved. But there are other ways to do it, too. If you happen to receive, then you're once God's child. But if you don't receive, you could still be God's child in a different way. This is not the tone of the New Testament. This is why there was such vigor in going out communicating the gospel, because people were in peril without it. This is why Jesus commanded them to preach, according to Peter's own words in Acts chapter 10, this message about forgiveness of sin. I mean, on and on and on. Paul says, you know, he's preaching, and I think it's Festus says, well, or Agrippa, King Agrippa, he says, you almost got me convinced. He says, oh, I would that I would convince you that you would be just like I am, save for these chains.
Yeah.
And on and on and on, you have this absolute intensity about this message, which suggests that there is something terrible to be lost by not embracing it. And I actually think that these different characterizations, like receive Christ or believe in Jesus or confess with your mouth, these are all phrases that are synonymous with the idea of expressing one's trust in Jesus. So that trust can be expressed by confessing, it could be by receiving, it could be by, you know, acknowledging or confessing, all these different terms, but they really amount to the same thing. That is, you imbibe of the bread from heaven, John chapter 6. And whoever believes in Jesus will not perish but have everlasting life.
Okay.
So it's that trust that is so vital in the New Testament. And this is why I'm going to insist that this is the persistent teaching of the New Testament. And there is, I don't see how it gives us any room for wiggling here, you know. And even in the mind of God, if he's got a little exception up there somewhere, he didn't feed that down to us. So anyway, Alden, I really appreciated the conversation.
Yeah, thank you very much for your time, Mr. Kokel. And I'm going to look forward to listening to the podcast and going over what you said a little bit more slowly.
Dynamite. And I'm sure we'll talk some more later.
Sounds good. I look forward to it.
Okay.
Sir.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye. That was a great call, ladies and gentlemen. I love callers who ask challenging questions and who want to get to the details and fuss about the particulars when the particulars matter. And I love a chance to clarify something that I've said in the past that might have been misunderstood. So both things there. Let's go to Robert. Let me find the button here, Robert. Huntington Beach, Robert, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg. Thank you very much for the hard work you do. Keep up the good work.
Thanks. Thank you.
I called several weeks ago about telling you about a story about my mother-in-law who was fired by the pastor.
Okay.
And, you know, basically went into that. And, well, the latest development is...
Right. Bring me up to date a little bit more, because I've heard a lot of stories in the last few weeks. So,
sorry about that. Okay, yeah. So basically what happened was the pastor...
Fired her because...
Well, because basically the way that she disagreed with her, she was very verbal about it.
This is a female pastor who disagreed.
No, she's not a female pastor. It's the pastor and my mother-in-law was the church secretary.
Uh huh.
And what had happened was the disagreement was verbal and consistent about how the pastor had been treating people, and
okay,
pretty much she said, you know, I'm entitled to respect in terms of my opinion, and she said no, you know.
Oh wait, this was the one where he says, you know, he gave the illustration out of the Gospels that the servant should just serve up
that's
the food,
right,
and doesn't get applauded.
That,
yeah, okay, I remember
right. And
that.
And you gave me your answer from St. Anselm, talking about that particular pastor. I forgot what it was.
I think the point was, we can't merit anything with God. You know, we do all the good things that we're supposed to do, and that doesn't get us ahead. That just makes us even with what we are obliged to do before God. But this isn't meant to inform personal relationships, because we have, you know, and I think that to bring the other listeners up to speed here, did you say mother-in-law?
Correct.
yeah, your mother-in-law was serving this pastor, but the pastor never had any kind words. And when she said, well, why don't you be nice to me or something like that, he said, look, it, like Jesus said, you know, you just do your job and whatever. And that's what we don't say, good job. We just say that's what you're supposed to do. So, you know, and it sounded like a fairly callous response and a misapplication of that passage by the pastor. Right.
That's right.
I'm with you now.
Okay. So from that point, my family and I have decided to leave the church and not to submit to the pastor, but to look for a new church.
Okay. I think that's good good counsel or good decision.
Certainly. I mean, I got a lot of good counsel from various Biola professors who know a lot more of the details. And,
yeah,
you know, they
right, right. And you're free to do that. Nobody says you have to stay in any particular church, right?
Yeah, and I think he said that too. The old pastor said that as well. But there was this, quote, leadership meeting, and a couple of friends of mine have been asking me, what do you think about this? And they sent me the notes. And basically what the pastor said was that this has now been a time or a season of sifting.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he said was in Judges chapter 7, verse 4, but the Lord said to Gideon, there are too many men. Take them down to the water, and I will sift them for you there. And this goes
right
on about the story about it. Are they going to lap up the water? Or are they gonna...
Right, and this is how God decides to winnow the fighting men down to 400 so they can take on the Midianites, right? And
right,
so he's saying this is what God is doing in his congregation, and so
the weak ones
have been winnowed out, like your mother-in-law.
And me as well, who basically have left because of the hard decisions that have to be made. But
no, yeah,
God is the one who is sifting, and I
yes
wanted to get your impression on that.
Yeah, but it doesn't. Well, I have a couple of thoughts. For one, it doesn't. It's not clear exactly who's been sifted out here. Maybe God is with your mother-in-law, and he just sifted out this stooge, you know, from her life. You know, maybe I shouldn't use that term to describe him because I don't know very much. But this kind of response is not a troublesome. Let me just put it in as neutral way as possible. He may be the one sifted out of their lives, okay, because of his incompetence in the way he deals with things. That's one thought. Secondly, when I hear things like this, another verse comes to mind, and that is, let the dead bury the dead. And what I mean by that in that application is, some people you just leave alone, and you let them go, and you don't mess with them anymore, because they're not worth the trouble. In this particular case, chapter 7, he may be citing this as an illustration of what he thinks God is doing, but the citing of the text in no way validates that that is exactly what God is doing in his case. Just because you can cite a text where this happens doesn't mean that God is at work here and he's on that pastor's side, which is what he's implying, it seems to me, by the response.
Right.
So
okay,
this was an historical situation that God did with Gideon here, and there is no reason to believe, it seems to me, that this is what God's doing in that circumstance. It sounds like a pious rationalization for not having to be sifted himself by the Holy Spirit through the members of his congregation that are reflecting back things that he ought to be taking seriously.
So how far should we go with submitting to a pastor, especially when we have verses like Hebrews 13:17, submit and obey to your leaders. They keep watch over you as men who must give an account.
Well, we are to, if you look in 1 Peter chapter 5, I think it's 5, maybe 4, but it talks about the leaders not ruling it over those in their flocks, but being examples to them. There is a relationship between leaders and flock, and the flock is supposed to be responsive to the leadership of the leaders and the pastors, and the pastors are also to be kind and generous to the flock as well. But this is not an absolute relationship. It's not like marriage where you're in for, you got one-way ticket. There are pastors who abuse their responsibilities. There are times when members of the congregation are, you know, may differ from the pastor, and they should just buckle up and say, okay, well, this is what I do. I was a staff pastor for 8 years in a church, and I had a boss who was the head pastor. He was also not just my boss, but my pastor. There were times when he taught things I didn't agree with. I didn't leave the congregation. Instead, I took my ideas to him in private, and I shared them with him, and then I said, okay, I've done my job. I've gave you these ideas, and I think that, you know, I'm trusting you to take them before the Lord and weigh them. Now, I don't think I changed his mind on very much or anything, to be honest with you. But none of those things.
Like, he still gave you the freedom to disagree with
him. Well, yeah, I had that, and in fact, it was my responsibility to tell him where I went, but where I thought there was a problem. But I went with my hat in my hand. I wasn't in charge. I said, "You're the head pastor, not me." So you know, I understood the pecking order and the chain of command, as it were.
Sure.
But at the same time, it did not get to the point where I did not feel I could sit under this person's leadership. If it got to that point, then I would leave. But until that point, then I do submit to the leadership in a way that's appropriate until such times I think that this is not leadership I can respect, and so I'm leaving. And then I go under somebody else's leadership whose leadership I respect. So that's why I'm saying it's not absolute. While I'm under that leadership, I have to express respect for that leadership in different fashions, different ways. But then if it gets to the point, and that wasn't the case with my pastor, I changed jobs is what happened in my case. But if it gets to the place where I cannot respect that leadership, then I could move out and go someplace else where I can. And that's entirely legitimate.
Thank you, Greg.
Okay, callers, hang on. Thank you so much for your call. I got another hour ahead of us, so is that Kevin and some other people on board? We'll be talking to you in hour number two on Stand to Reason.
Are you talking to me?
Hour number two on Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kokel with you every weekend. I hate it when I mispronounce my own name. Yeah. With you every weekend for free, wheeling, open discussion of contemporary ethical issues, defense of classical Christianity, showing you that Christianity is worth thinking about. Well, we've got a bunch of people on the line that have been hanging on for a while, and so I'm going to hold back on my comments about the momentous shift youths increasingly shunning Christianity poll finds. This is another Barna poll, and maybe next week when I come on board, I'll tell you a little bit about this, and I'm as much concerned about the poll as I am about the poll's results, because you would think... Now I'm getting into it a little bit, and I don't want to do that. But let me just say this. You would think that a pollster would be more careful about the way they ask questions. Apparently, one of the questions was, I won't get to that. All right. I'll talk about this next week, all right? And maybe I should do a little bit more research on this detail. But I want to talk to you callers, 1-800-227-5278. And in the 714 area code, 754-4150, let's go to... Bonneville, Nebraska?
Is Bonneville, right? Alberta.
Alberta. Bonneville's like the car. They don't still make that car, do they?
I'm not sure.
It's like an Oldsmobile, wasn't it?
It's the same type of name.
All right. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two questions hopefully we can get to.
Right.
The first one is there's a line of thinking, if there is such a thing as evil, then there's such a thing as good.
Right.
If there's such a thing as good, then there has to be some standard, some moral law that we can measure good and evil by.
Yes.
If there is such a thing as that moral law, there must be a moral law giver.
Right.
That's where my question is at.
Okay, you're comfortable with the first two steps.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
When I get into conversations about this, this is where I get asked, okay, well, why does there have to be a moral law giver? If there's a moral law, why can't it just be a moral law? Why can't there be other reasons for it besides a moral law giver?
Okay, I wrote about this in the last chapter in the book on relativism. Are you familiar with that book?
Yes, I've read it.
Okay, well, the last chapter I actually address this, but let me walk through my thinking on this. What you have to do first... in a way, it's very, very scientific in its methodology, which means you make some observations and then you ask questions about the observations. You see the way things are, and then you ask questions about what best explains those things. Okay, so what's in question now is morality. We have morality. We have evil, which is a violation of an objective standard of good. And by the way, this concept of it being objective is important. But you don't contest that, right?
That's correct.
Okay, it's an objective standard of good. It's real good. It's a real standard. It's not just somebody's opinion. There's an objective standard, okay?
Yep.
And so some people want to argue, well, this is just part of the furniture of the universe. We just find it, and therefore that's all we need to do. Here's my question. When one looks at morality or goodness or moral principles of sort, then I think we can make some observations about what they're like. So we're going to flesh this out a little bit. First of all, there's a certain incumbency to morality. There's a certain oughtness to it. So it isn't just like a rule on the wall and says, don't bark. The nature of it is that it actually requires obedience. Do you see what I'm saying? There's an oughtness about it. We actually have an obligation with regards to the rule. We ought not bark. It isn't just a statement. Not only that, as moral obligations seem to be, well, you can express them in terms of propositions. They have objects, you know, like barking in this case, and there's a moral term that applies to it. Propositions. Okay, so I'm just going to. So there's an incumbency to it. There's an oughtness to it. They can be expressed propositionally. Okay, and when you think about the nature, and part of the oughtness is that it entails an obligation. But when you think about the nature of obligations, obligations are usually held between persons. I have an obligation to you, Kevin. I don't have an obligation to your book. Unless I have an obligation to treat your book in a certain way because you own the book. And so in that sense, it's just another way of saying I have an obligation to you. Obligations seem to be the kinds of things that are held between persons, not that are held between things. So all of these things then come to bear on the question of the grounding of moral obligations. Now, have you heard this term before, grounding?
Yes.
Okay, the grounding question is the question that asks of any given thing, why is the thing the way it is? What best makes sense of this thing that we've discovered? So when we see a universe that follows natural laws, let's say, we can say, well, why would the universe be the kind of universe that is thick with natural laws and certain uniformities? Why wouldn't things be chaotic? It could have been that way, it seems. And so then one wants to ask the question, why is the world this way rather than something else? What is the best explanation for that? And the same thing can be said or asked of morality. Given that we are acknowledging that morality is a particular thing, there is evil and there is good, evil is a departure from an objective standard of good, so we're kind of beholding this standard of good. And then we ask some questions about what is that like? So we're observing the thing. It's like you come upon a new species of animal or something you've never seen before, and you start making observations about it. And that kind of helps you to maybe, as you observe it, you might come to some conclusion about what explains it, how it got to be the way it is or whatever. Oh, okay, and then it starts coming to you. In the same way, we're looking at morality, we're looking at more detail of it. And it seems with all the particular things that we notice about morality, that it can be stated in propositional form, that it has a certain oughtness to it, that obligations are held between persons, etc., that this is better explained as the result of something personal rather than something not personal. If I had, say, a Scrabble board, and I was playing Scrabble with you, Kevin, and I dumped out a bunch of Scrabble tiles, and all of a sudden this sentence appears in the Scrabble tiles, and it's conceivable, you know, maybe a simple sentence like, do not go. Now, what if you and I were just talking about going to Las Vegas? Okay? And right when we are saying, I'm trying to wonder whether I should go or not, and then I see these Scrabble tiles spell do not go. Now, that looks like a command. Okay? Are you with me? Still there, Kevin?
Yep,
okay.
I'm following you fine.
Grunt or breathe hard or something. Bang two rocks together. All right, good.
We'll do.
All right. So you are so I see this. Now, what do you and I make of this set of letters that have fallen together into what appears to be a sentence? Is that a command with regards to the thing we were just discussing? Does it seem to make sense to call it a command?
Probably not. It seems like, to me, it would seem like a big coincidence.
Okay,
some people certainly would take it as a command.
But why would they be inclined to take it as a command? I agree some people would, but only a certain type of person would be inclined to do that.
Someone who's superstitious.
Yes, but... Yeah, that's true. I was thinking another person. It might be. It's ironic, though, but you identify somebody who would just take it as a command out of nowhere as superstitious, but this is really what a morality without the grounding of a personal moral maker amounts to, is a command out of nowhere. So it already sounds a little suspect to your mind. I think that most people would not give it any consideration. They would not consider it a sentence, and if not a sentence, then certainly not a command. No incumbency to it, unless they had a religious point of view of some sort, mystical religious point of view, that someone was using the tiles of the Scrabble game to communicate a message regarding what you were just talking about. And that would fit my paradigm. In other words, if you're a Christian and maybe a little pietistic or whatever, mystical, you might think, oh, maybe God is trying to tell me something. But you see, that's my point. You wouldn't take it as a command unless you thought someone was communicating. It's a type of communication. It's a proposition. It's a requirement. And therefore, these things don't make sense apart from a personal agent that is involved with it, that in a meaningful way. That's the grounding problem of morality.
Okay.
Now, one could say, oh, well, I'm just going to declare that no mind is needed. And then I'm going to say, well, you're free to do that, but then what you're doing is you're denying. How do you then explain the incumbency of morality, the propositional nature of morality, where the objective standard of right and wrong comes from? You just kind of declare. It sounds like it's cheating. When we have a better explanation at our disposal, why wouldn't you go there? It's kind of like saying, okay, I've got a piece of paper here. Here it is. It's a Stand to Reason streaming. Now you can listen online, Stand to Reason. I got this piece of paper in front of me. And I could somebody say, who typed that? I said, nobody. He said, wait a minute, it's words. I can read it. It has to do with your program. Yeah. Well, doesn't that make sense? Somebody would type it? Maybe, but nobody did. How do you know nobody did? Because I don't believe in other people typing things. But there's an example of people typing something. Why would you believe that? Because I just don't. So there you go. Now, you would think I was a little silly, right?
Yeah.
I'm kind of like denying the obvious explanation to believe in something that is totally counterintuitive in light of the thing we're talking about. But that's my response to people who want to acknowledge the existence of morality but deny any grounding for it. But and another thing, why does morality apply to human beings and not to animals? And it has nothing to do with our intelligence level, I guarantee you. Because there's nothing about rationality, the laws of reason, that inform us anything about morality. Just like there's nothing about rationality that tells us about beauty. They're different classes of things.
Okay, that's a good point.
So that human beings are moral creatures and personal creatures, and that morality seems to have these certain characteristics, it seems to me far and away the best explanation for such a thing is a personal being who in some way grounds morality. Now, there are different ways to describe the way in which God grounds it. That's a different discussion. But but somehow moral obligation would have to be towards a person. Now, if somebody said to me, no, we don't need God, I said, really, then why not? Because I'm just going to believe we don't. Then that strikes me as profoundly anti-intellectual, which is just what these people don't want to believe, that they're anti-intellectual. They think they're really smart. So, okay, Kevin?
Yep.
Does that help?
Yes, it helps a lot.
Okay, keep thinking about it. Give me a call when you've something else comes up, all right?
Okay.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. You know, this is exactly the discussion that I had with Gary Wills when I was at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco 2.5 weeks ago. Though he was Roman Catholic and he believed in God and believed in morality, he thought the Enlightenment, which rejected the existence of God by and large in any meaningful sense to this discussion, was fully capable of grounding morality. In fact, he said there's 1,000 systems of ethics that show that rationality can ground morality. Ladies and gentlemen, there don't exist 1,000 systems of ethics. Ethics is a subset of the field of philosophy. I've got advanced degrees in this, and maybe a dozen. Maybe. I mean, you got virtue ethics, you got deontological ethics, you got utilitarianism, you have emotivism, which is just another form of relativism, kind of. And that's four. I'm running out already. You don't have 1,000. You got half a dozen or a few more. And they don't, by the way, try to ground morality and rationality. What rationality can do, if what you mean by rationality is not just the deliverances of reason, but one's mental capabilities, the capabilities of a reasonable, rational soul. One can intuit what is right and wrong, generally speaking. That is, that there are rational intuitions that might allow us to know what is right and wrong, but knowing right and wrong is an epistemological enterprise. Answering the question, what causes it to be that way, why is the world this way, it's an ontological question. Gary Wills said, an atheist can figure out, 1,000 people can figure out, through rationality, what the right thing to do is. And I said, yes, 1,000 people can watch an apple fall towards the earth too. But that isn't going to teach them about what gravity is. Gravity is what grounds the activity. And by the same token, our activity is moral motions and moral activity, and we want to ask the question, what makes sense of that? Why is the world this way? What worldview helps explain this best? And far and away, a theistic worldview does that. Okay, more calls in just a moment. I'm Greg Kokel at Stand to Reason.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
The dictionary defines the word expand this way: a verb, to open up, to unfold, to increase the extent, number, volume, or scope of. Stand to Reason's focus in 2007 is expanding horizons, a goal born out of our desire to increase your understanding of what it means to be Christ's ambassador and to open up the riches of truth in new ways and explore new ways to be more effective as an ambassador for Christ. No conference is better at doing that than our annual Master Series in Christian Thought. This year's lineup of speakers will challenge you to expand your horizons as you face the pressures of being a Christian in today's world. These extraordinary minds will broaden and deepen your understanding of truth amidst an antagonistic and divisive culture. Never has the need been greater for Christians who confidently and competently defend what they believe. You can order the lectures individually, or even better, you can benefit from the entire series. Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. James Emery White, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, and our own Greg Kokel and Alan Schliemann. Visit str.org or call 800-2-REASON to order this series that will expand your horizons.
show Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kolkle, your host. And this is the place, of course, where you can have a shopping spree in the marketplace of ideas. I'm here every Sunday to give you a piece of my mind, and that's all I ask of you. 1-800-227-5278. And back to the phone, and then she had Seth, and once again, people called on the name of the Lord. Seth from Savannah, Georgia. Did you know that's where your name came from, Seth? Seth?
How was that?
Wait, did I push the right button?
Hello?
Hello. Who's this? Is this Sean?
It's Seth.
Seth. Okay, I did push the right button. Okay, Seth. From Savannah, welcome to the show.
Hey, first, I want to say I appreciate your ministry here. It really helped me as I was coming back to, mm-hmm. to faith. And
good.
Definitely started supporting it.
Good. Glad to hear that. What's on your mind?
The question is, I've been studying a lot lately, and I've been studying this one guy who's been teaching something. I just want to throw it past you to see how well it computes.
Mm-hmm.
The concept is between grace and law,
mm-hmm.
and basically is explaining the idea of imputing sin. And
okay.
What it was is he explained after Adam, up until the law, there wasn't any law that was necessarily in place there.
Mm-hmm.
An example he gave was like Cain was the first murderer, but he didn't, really nothing too bad happened to him. It was kind of like a gracious.
Okay, that's interesting you bring that up, because I was going to bring that up as an example as I was thinking about your question, but let's go past that now. And so he says there is no law, and so once the law comes,
Once the law comes, then sin starts getting imputed.
Okay, sin isn't imputed to human beings at all. Sin is imputed to Christ. Righteousness is imputed. And now maybe you're not, or he's not using his words accurately, but imputation is when you add it to the account of, as opposed to earning it yourself. If I give you $50 and you put it into your savings account, that money is imputed. If you earn $50, that's earned. That's different. So people who sin earn they have earned their sin, if you will. They are personally responsible. It's not imputed. When Jesus dies for our sins are imputed to him. And his righteousness is imputed to us. So imputation is when you get something you didn't earn. Does that make sense? Hello?
Yep.
Okay, I wanted to be clear on terms here.
Right, I think where I was coming from was this verse that goes...
that there was no sin, no imputation of sin before there was any law.
Right, sin is not imputed where there is no law.
Okay.
Not sure which is the text from that.
I've heard this. Now, okay, then the question is, okay, I see. Now, they're using the word imputation in a different sense. That could be earned. All right. Okay. My bad on that one. So the question is, when he says there is no law, and I don't know what the context, I'd have to go back to that verse itself. First question that comes to mind is, when he says there is no law, does he mean the Mosaic law? Or does he mean law in general?
Well, he was specifically, Paul was specifically talking about the time between Adam and the law being given, because he was like, nevertheless, until then, sin reigned.
Yeah.
Unto death.
Well, then how could? All right. Well, I'm not sure how I'm going to be able to answer this, because I know that this passage you're referring to talks about sin not being imputed without law. So that means that are we to suggest that are we to believe that there either was no sin before there was a law, or the sin was not held to anyone's account before the law came?
I think that's the premise that he was shooting for.
Okay.
That sin wasn't held to anybody's account. And the explanation, part of it was once the law came, then the first person, I think he used a thing about someone did something on the Sabbath day, and then they were killed.
Okay.
Whereas Cain was a murderer.
Right.
And nothing happened to him.
Right. Well, I wouldn't say that nothing happened to him.
Well, I mean, and nothing that extreme.
Well, and there was no theocracy there, so there was no system of punishment that related to this official law being given. But I wouldn't exactly say the approbation of God was something that's not extreme. Like he got off lightly, maybe that's what the guy means. But what he did was wrong, and he was held responsible for it. Now, here's another question that I have. I mean, I think it's that phrase, like, before the law there was no imputation of sin or something like that. What is going on there? And my principle in these kind of situations is if I don't know for sure what is going on, sometimes I can eliminate options. I could say, well, I'm not exactly sure what that verse means, and that's the case right now as I sit here. I don't know exactly all the ramifications of that, but here's one thing I'm sure it doesn't mean, that it doesn't mean that there was no sin before there was law. Because clearly there was sin. You know, when God destroyed the earth with the flood, he says all the intentions of man's heart were evil continually. Okay, and so what did God do? He judged by killing them all. In other words, it was an act of judgment against their crimes against God, their doing of evil. Now, there was no law given then, but there still was punishment. So there was both sin and punishment for sin, even way back there in the early chapters of the book of Genesis. And we see things like that all the way up till the time the law was given, people doing things that they shouldn't have done. When the law was given to Moses and the Jews. None of the Gentile nations had that. But the Gentile nations still were under the condemnation of God, and Paul makes this clear in the book of Ephesians, where he talks about that the Gentiles were born without the law and without hope. They were under God's judgment for the crimes that they had been given. And part of the reason that Paul could say that is because in Romans chapter 2, he talks about Gentiles who, even though they haven't been given the Mosaic law, still have a law in their heart. They demonstrate the law that is written in their heart. Verse 12 of chapter 2, for all who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law. And here the concept of the law is the Mosaic law, I think. And all who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law. So there is a law for the Jews that will judge them. And then there is another law that isn't the Jewish law, but it is the law written in men's hearts that they know about, because it convicts their soul. They talk about this. I'm looking for the particular verse here in chapter. It's either chapter, somewhere in chapter 2 of book of Romans. It evades me. Oh, here it is, verse 14. When Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively the things of the law, these not having the law are a law to themselves. And they show the work of the law written on their hearts, which with their conscience bearing witness. So, when I go to this passage in question, and neither of us know exactly where it is right now, whatever Paul is talking about, he couldn't be meaning that there is no sin before the Mosaic law, and he couldn't be meaning that there is no judgment of sin before the Mosaic law, because we have other texts that clearly tell us the opposite.
Right.
And that's so, kind of my guideline in a situation like this.
Okay. So what I was setting up was in the New Covenant, which was foretold before. It was like this old covenant's going to pass away.
That's
and
the right.
New covenant's going to come.
Jeremiah 31:30, 31.
Right.
Yeah.
And I was regarding some other comments you said before about it's like, well, once you're saved, you still commit sins.
Yes.
But
I do.
Not right.
I imagine you do too. Okay.
Yeah, and for a while, I was struggling with that concept because there's a lot of things where it's like, it gets the impression that you're supposed to meet up to some standard once you become a Christian.
Well, we're always supposed to meet up to the standard. I mean, that goes, you know, I guess without saying, but I guess it doesn't. I mean, the standard is still there. We ought to obey, but we don't always obey. We're in the process of learning to do that better. So how is it that we survive with a holy God in the midst of that process? We survive because we are covered by Jesus. He is our advocate, and so he comes alongside of us, and he's our defense. It's like having an umbrella. The wrath of God is poured out against sin, but Jesus is that umbrella who's received the wrath of God, and therefore we are then before the Father, not being viewed as the way we were, and in fact experientially are, sinning, but we are viewed as Jesus is in terms of righteousness. There's a trade that went on. Jesus got our sin, and we got his righteousness for the sake of God's bookkeeping. And this was what allows us, this is 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21. He made him who knew no sin to become sin on our behalf, that we might become the righteousness of God in him. And this, I think, we received when we became a believer. And now it's just kind of the working out of that. That's the sanctification part. So we are obliged to do what's right. The law still applies to us in a certain sense, but it is not our means of justification that Jesus alone accomplishes. Does that make sense, Seth?
Yeah, it does. I'm saying these things in regards to something that I know this one, you had that article, Clarification on Confession.
Yes, uh-huh.
And the point that this one guy was teaching is that most religious systems, even within Christianity, are teaching that you have to do things to maintain your relationship. It's like, first you get saved by faith, but then it's like, okay, now it's your efforts that maintain the relationship.
Okay,
like,
well, just for clarification.
Enough.
Right, right, right. That's right. Now, when he says relationship, I suspect you mean to maintain your justification. Because the reason I make this distinction is because if what one means is the relationship, that is their kind of day-to-day sense of communion, it is the case for us that we have to do things to maintain, from our perspective, the day-to-day sense of communion with God. If you're not praying to God or reading the Word or reflecting or trying to obey and doing a whole bunch of other things that have to do with being in relationship with God, your relationship with God from your side of things is going to dry up. And that happens a lot to people. That doesn't mean that God thinks any differently about you or somehow we've lost our justification. But it does mean that there are things that we do to continue to nourish what God has begun when we became followers of Jesus. Does that make sense?
Right. I guess my total problem with it is like... Or my problem, not the problem with that, but my problem personally is like dealing with it from being like trying to be conscious of sins, or should I be trying to, you know, rest in the sufficiency of Christ in that,
right,
in that respect? Because I was studying in Hebrews about the one sacrifice,
right,
and the other sacrifice. I think you mentioned it in that same article.
I did.
About if the sacrifices were good enough, then you should not be conscious of sin.
Right, yeah, there's exactly. It's not, well, the point it was making is that there's a reminder of sins all the time through the sacrificial system, and that shows that the sin has not been forgiven. It hasn't been completely done. And and it shows that there'll be a future sacrifice that will take care of sin once for all. Using that as a text, then I thought, well, if what we are trying to do is conjure up a memory of all of our sins through a confessing process, well, then that's accomplishing the same thing that was accomplished by the Old Testament law, but it doesn't seem to be in keeping with the New Testament, New Covenant, in which you have one sacrifice once for all. And so that was the line of thinking there. So as for myself, I do not go around trying to figure out all the things I've done wrong during the day. I don't try to remind myself of those things. When I am aware of what I've done wrong, when I do it, and usually that's like almost immediately, or when the Holy Spirit brings this to mind a couple of minutes later, I thought, oh, I know what was going on there. When I spoke this way to my wife, I was really being kind of crabby, and that was a mistake. And that's when I address it with God. I guess you could call that confessing. I just apologize, and I just move on. I say, okay, help me with that. I clear the deck. Help me with that in the future and move forward. And I think that's the value of that kind of reflection. But I don't try to dig up old stuff. All right, Seth, thanks. Got to run to break. Greg Kokel, more to come on Stand to Reason. Hi, this is Greg Kokel, letting you know that Stand to Reason is back with an unmatched cruise conference experience featuring some of the top Christian thinkers in the country. On August 2nd, 2008, we'll set sail from Vancouver, BC for 8 days aboard one of Holland America's finest cruise ships. We're planning a voyage you'll never forget. It's specifically designed for those who want to represent Christ to a world looking for answers to life's toughest questions. Here's our plan. We want to challenge you with thoughtful presentations, answer your questions in open forum discussions, and enrich helps you through interaction and fellowship with expert speakers and fellow passengers. Add to that the stunning splendor of the Alaskan coastline and a 7-day itinerary that includes Glacier Bay, Skagway, Juneau, and Ketchikan. I'll be joined by some of our distinguished guest speakers, Josh McDowell, J.P. Moreland, and Sean McDowell. Come and join Stand to Reason and our lineup of speakers for a memorable spiritual adventure. You'll enjoy plenty of fun and relaxation, along with ample opportunity to meet our speakers, ask questions, and enjoy each other's company. Listen, if studying Christian subjects with some of the sharpest minds on the planet in the fellowship of other believers of kindred spirit aboard a beautiful ship sailing the Alaskan coastline sounds like your idea of a perfect vacation, then this is the trip for you. As always, you don't need any prior understanding of the subject matter. Simply bring a desire to learn in a relaxing environment. We planned everything about this trip with your enjoyment and your enrichment in mind. But don't just take my word for it. Visit STR.org and see what other guests of Stand to Reason have said about past STR cruises. Save the dates, download the brochure from STR.org, and then contact Inspiration Cruises and Tours at 800-247-1899. They're helping us with our trip, and their skilled staff are committed to answering all your questions. I look forward to seeing you on board. Greg Kokel back with you here at Christianity Worth Thinking About. That's Stand to Reason. With you every Sunday, 3 to 5, generally, 3 to 5. Although Southern California is going off in 10 minutes. So let's go right to the phones again and get Sean in Appleton, Wisconsin. Hello, Sean.
Hi there.
How you doing?
Pretty good.
What's up?
My phone might die, so I'll go quick here.
All right.
I'm wondering about the inspiration of the New Testament beyond the Gospels.
Okay.
How do we build a case for that? I know people use the verse in 2 Timothy that all Scripture is God-breathed.
Right.
But the New Testament wasn't complete at that time.
That's correct. What 2 Timothy is talking about is the characteristics of Scripture, the writings that are given. And the nature of it is that they're actually breathed of God through the writers so that they're profitable for the purposes identified there in verse 16 of chapter 3 of 2 Timothy. It doesn't identify which things are Scripture, and this makes it a little bit more difficult. Certainly the Old Testament, which is referenced earlier on in that chapter, the sacred writings would qualify. We can also go to other passages. In the upper room, in John 14, I believe, then or 15, Jesus says to his apostles that he will bring to remembrance all things that he has taught to them, you know, and that the Holy Spirit would guide them into all truth. This is a promise given to the disciples and the apostles in that upper room. I do not think that that particular promise is for all Christians. And this seems to be Jesus giving in advance the authority for them to speak in a way that is the rule for the church. And the word rule means canon. In the Gospel of Luke, I'm trying to remember, Luke, and just going by memory here, Luke identifies, he quotes, I can't remember now. Let's go to 2 Peter chapter 3, and Peter there says that many people have a hard time understanding what Paul has written, and sometimes they distort Paul as they do the rest of the Scriptures. So it seems that Peter is acknowledging that the writings of Paul are Scripture, and he's keeping them on the same level as the Old Testament Scriptures. We have another place, too, where something from one of the Gospels is quoted and something from the Old Testament is quoted as if they were on par and as Scripture. And so all of these things seem to be examples of having the same authority as the Old Testament Scriptures, which are clearly in view in 2 Timothy chapter 3. So there is a little bit of a line of argument that is somewhat inductive by looking at the instances and the way the New Testament talks about the other writers that seems to treat the New Testament documents with the same authority as the Old Testament documents, which clearly come under the provision of that 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 16, characterization. If you notice in Galatians chapter 1, I think, Paul says he went and he got a revelation from Jesus, which is basically his understanding of the gospel. And then he went and he took that to the pillars of the faith, Peter, James, and John, there in Jerusalem, to make sure that he had not been running in vain. So this is another implicit claim that these people are, in some cases, it's explicit, these people are speaking with authority from God. The idea that Jesus left behind this group of 12 apostles that spoke canon, that is the rule for the church, as though they were speaking for God, is well established in the early church period. And the writers during that time acknowledged that. So you have this kind of a combination of lines of thinking that move towards identifying this group of writings here in the New Testament as being part of the corpus of revelation that God has given, starting with the Old Testament and on to the apostolic witness in the New. So it falls under the same heading. Now, I admit that that is not what I would consider entirely tidy, okay? But it's I think it's a legitimate line of thinking. The problem is there's no extra-biblical document that has divine authority that identifies where God says, okay, here are the people that are going to be writing Scripture. It just isn't there. So it's a matter of a kind of induction, deduction kind of working together there. Sean, I hope that helps. I'm going to have to run over to Dave in Oklahoma here to get our last question in just a couple of minutes. Is it Dave? In Atlanta, rather. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question for you with respect to women in ministry.
Right.
Is it legitimate for a woman to be ordained as a pastor, reverend, minister, or whatever, and whether or not that female has a church or not, in the sense that there might not be the pastor, because there might
right.
be an assistant pastor, but just the whole process, is that legitimate?
Okay, here's where I go for my, I was just talking to the enforcer about it. A lot of people go to 1 Timothy chapter 2, and it says, I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man. I do not think that, now this is New American Standard, I don't think chapter 2 is a good place to make your point, because I think good arguments could be offered to demonstrate that when Paul is talking about this in 1 Timothy 2, there are women receiving instruction with entire submissiveness, etc. I think he's talking about husband-wife relationships there. I don't have time to go into the details, but okay. I think I have this on the internet. There's a piece that I've written that's on our website. However, I do think that he addresses the question in chapter 3. There, specifically, the question of church leadership is in view. And I think it's very clear in this passage that men are to be the leaders in the church, not women. Now, that doesn't mean a woman can't be a pastor. A pastor is a shepherd, as long as she's a shepherd under a man and not her own boss, as it were. I think this means in chapter 3 that a woman cannot be part of the ruling group of the church. That would be elders or a ruling pastor. Sometimes you have a pastor that rules the church. That's the model now in America. It's not biblical, but it's the way it works. Certainly the same prescriptions would apply. Women shouldn't be in charge of the whole thing. They can work for a pastor, be a shepherd of sorts, and I think they can teach men, because I don't think that chapter 2 deals with proscribing women to teach. But I do think chapter 3 proscribes women from being in a position of authority over the rest of the church.
Okay, so they can be ordained and legitimate as a pastor, just that they have to be ruling under.
Yeah, exactly. Being ordained, and even the term pastor, is largely a human enterprise. You can be ordained or licensed or whatever. Ordination isn't magical, in my view. It's something that the body does to acknowledge a role that you play in the body. And so if it is legitimate for a woman to be a shepherd in some capacity in the body of Christ, I don't see what's wrong with the body saying, okay, we're going to acknowledge that, and we're going to ordain you. We're going to officially state that you're in that role in this local church. I don't have a problem with that. I have a problem when a woman is a senior pastor or when a woman is on the elder board and that she's in a position of governing. And it's not because I'm a misogynist or something. I just think that's what Paul says here, what he means in 1 Timothy chapter 3, not 1 Timothy 2, but 1 Timothy 3. So I'll let you chew on that, Dave. I've got to say goodbye to my Southern California and Los Angeles, obviously, audience. But for the rest of you on the rest of our network, you can stay tuned for more of Stand to Reason.